Think we have gone awry. Let us return as we came, my lord. The riders turned their mounts and started back. They passed beneath the tree again and then rode off, still widely spaced, heading into sunlight. Perhaps in better light we shall find their track. Chris gave a long sigh of relief. The boy below tapped him on the leg and nodded to him as if to say, good work. They waited until the riders were at least 100 yards away, nearly out of sight. Then the boy slipped quietly down the tree, and Chris followed as best he could. Once on the ground, Chris saw the riders moving off. They were coming to the tree with the muddy footprints. The Black Knight passed it, not noticing. Then the next, the boy grabbed his arm, pulled him away, slipping off in the underbrush. Then, Sir Guy, look you here, the tree, they are in the tree. One of the knights had noticed. Shit. The riders spun on their mounts, looking up at the tree. The Black Knight came back, skeptical. Eh? Show me. I do not see them up there, my lord. The knights turned, looked back, looked in all directions, looked behind them, and they saw them. There! The riders charged. The boy ran hard. God's truth, we are lost now, he said, glancing over his shoulder as he raced forward. Can you swim? Swim? Chris said. Of course he could swim, but that was not what he was thinking about, because right now they were running hard, flat out, toward the clearing, toward the break in the trees, toward the cliff. The land sloped downward, gently at first, then more steeply. The ground cover became thinner, with exposed patches of yellow-white limestone. The sunlight was glaring. The Black Knight bellowed something. Chris didn't understand it. They came at last to the edge of the clearing. Without hesitation, the boy leapt into space. Chris hesitated, not wanting to follow. Glancing back, he saw the knights charging him, their broadswords raised. No choice. Chris turned and ran forward toward the cliff edge. Merrick winced as he heard Chris's scream in his earpiece. The scream was loud at first, then abruptly ended with a grunt and a crashing sound. An impact. He stood with Kate by the trail, listening, waving. They heard nothing more. Not even the crackle of static. Nothing at all. Is he dead? Kate said. Merrick didn't answer her. He walked quickly to Gomez's body, crouched down, and started searching in the mud. Come on, he said. Help me find that spare marker. They searched for the next few minutes, and then Merrick grabbed Gomez's hand, already turning pale gray, the muscles stiffening. He lifted her arm, feeling the coldness of her skin, and turned her torso over. The body splashed back in the mud. That was when he noticed that Gomez had a bracelet of braided twine on her wrist. Merrick hadn't noticed it before. It seemed to be part of her period costume. Of course, it was completely wrong for the period. Even a modest peasant woman would wear a bracelet of metal or carved stone or wood if she wore anything at all.
This was a hippy-dippy modern thing.
Merrick touched it curiously, and he was surprised to find it was stiff, almost like cardboard. He turned it on her wrist looking for the latch, and a sort of lid flicked open in the braided twine, and he realized that the bracelet covered a small electronic timer, like a wristwatch. The timer read 36 hours, 10 minutes, 37 seconds, and it was counting backward. He knew at once what it was. It was an elapsed counter for the machine, showing how much time they had left. They had 37 hours initially, and now they had lost about 50 minutes. We should hold on to this, he thought. He untied the bracelet from her arm, then wrapped it around his own wrist. He flipped the little lid shut. We've got a timer, Kate said, but no marker. They searched for the next 5 minutes. And finally, reluctantly, Merrick had to admit the hard truth. There was no marker. And without a marker, the machines would not come back. Chris was right. They were trapped there.
36 hours, 28 minutes, 4 seconds. In the control room, an alarm rang insistently. The technicians both got up from their consoles and started out of the room. Stern felt Gordon grab him firmly by the arm.
We have to go, Gordon said. The air's contaminated from the hydrofluoric acid.
The transit pad is toxic, and the fumes will be up here too soon enough. He began to lead Stern out of the control room. Stern glanced back at the screen at the jumble of girders and smoke in the transit site. But what if they try to come back when everybody is gone?
Don't worry, Gordon said. That can't happen. The wreckage will trigger the infrared. The sensors need 6 feet on all sides, remember? 2 meters. They don't have it. So the sensors won't let the machines come back. Not until we get all that cleared away.
How long will it take to clear it away?
First, we have to exchange the air in the cave.
Gordon took Stern back to the long corridor leading to the main elevator. There were a lot of people in the corridor, all leaving. Their voices echoed in the tunnel.
Exchange the air in the cave? Stern said. That's a huge volume. How long will that take?
Gordon said,
in theory, it takes 9 hours.
In theory?
We've never had to do it before, Gordon said. But we have the capacity, of course. The big fan should cut in any minute.
A few seconds later, a roaring sound filled the tunnel. Stern felt a blast of wind press his body, tug at his clothes. And after they exchange all the air, what then?
We rebuild the transit pad and wait for them to come back, Gordon said, just the way we were planning to do.
And if they try to come back before you're ready for them?
It's not a problem, David. The machine will just refuse. It'll pop them right back to where they were, for the time being.
So they're stranded, Stern said.
For the moment, Gordon said. Yes, they're stranded, and there's nothing we can do about it.
36 hours, 1 minute, 17 seconds. Chris Hughes ran to the edge of the cliff and threw himself into space, screaming, arms and legs flailing in the sunlight. He saw the Dordogne 200 feet below, snaking through the green countryside. It was too far to fall. He knew the river was too shallow. There was no question he would die. But then he saw the cliff face beneath him was not sheer. There was a protruding shelf of land 20 feet below, jutting out from the upper rim of the cliff. It was steeply angled bare rock with a sparse cover of scrubby trees and brush. He slammed down on the shelf, landing on his side, the impact blasting the air from his lungs. Immediately he began rolling helplessly toward the edge. He tried to stop the roll, clutching desperately at underbrush, but it was all too weak and it tore away in his hands. As he tumbled toward the edge, he was aware of the boy reaching for him, but Chris missed his outstretched arms. He continued to roll, his world spinning out of control. Now the boy was behind him with a horrified look on his face. Chris knew he was going to go over the edge. He was going to fall. With a grunt, he slammed into a tree. He felt a sharp pain in his stomach. Then it streaked through his whole body. For a moment, he did not know where he was. He felt only pain. The world was greenish-white. He came back to it slowly. The tree had broken his descent. But for a moment, he still could not breathe at all. The pain was intense. Stars swam before his eyes, then slowly faded, and finally he saw his legs were dangling over the edge of the cliff. And moving. Moving downward. The tree was a spindly pine, and his weight was slowly, slowly bending it over. He felt himself begin to slide along the trunk. He was helpless to stop it. He grabbed at the trunk and held tightly, and it worked. He wasn't sliding anymore. He pulled himself along the trunk, working his way back to the rock. Then, to his horror, he saw the roots of the tree begin to break free of the rocky crevices, one by one snapping loose, pale in the sunlight. It was only a matter of time before the entire trunk broke free. Then he felt a tug at his collar and saw the boy standing above him, hauling him back to his feet. The boy looked exasperated.
Come, now!
Jesus,
Chris said. He flopped onto a flat rock, gasping for breath.
Just give me a minute.
The arrow whined past his ear like a bullet. He felt the wind of its passage. He was stunned by the power of it. Energized by fear, he scrambled along the shelf, bent over, pulling himself from tree to tree. Another arrow snapped down through the trees. On the cliff above, the horsemen were looking down on them. The Black Knight shouted, "Fool! Idiot!" and cuffed the archer angrily, knocking the bow from his hands. There were no more arrows. The boy pulled Chris forward by the arm. Chris didn't know where the path along the cliff went, but the boy seemed to have a plan. Above him, the horseman wheeled, turned away, heading back into the woods. Now the shelf ended in a narrow ledge no more than a foot wide, which curved around an angle in the cliff. Below the ledge was a sheer drop to the river. Chris stared at the river, but the boy grabbed his chin, jerked his head up.
Do not look down. Come. The boy pressed himself flat against the cliff face, hugging the rock, and moved gingerly along on the ledge. Chris followed his example, still gasping for breath. He knew if he hesitated at all, panic would overcome him. The wind tugged at his clothes, pulling him away from the cliff. He pressed his cheek to the warm rock, clutching at finger holds, fighting panic. He saw the boy disappear around the corner. Chris kept going. The corner was sharp and the path beneath had fallen away, leaving a gap. He had to step across it carefully, but then he rounded the corner and sighed in relief. He saw the cliff now ended in a long green slope of forested land, which continued all the way down to the river. The boy was waving to him. Chris moved ahead, rejoining the boy. From here it is easier. The boy started down, Chris behind him. Almost at once he realized the slope was not as gentle as it had appeared. It was dark beneath the trees, steep and muddy. The boy slipped, slid along the muddy track, and vanished into the forest below. Chris continued to pick his way downward, grabbing branches for support. Then he too lost his footing, slapped down in the mud on his backside, and slid. For some reason, he thought, I am a graduate student at Yale. I am an historian, specializing in the history of technology. It was as if he was trying to hold on to an identity that was rapidly fading from his awareness, like a dream from which he had awakened and was now forgetting. Sliding headlong in the mud, Chris banged into trees, felt branches scratch at his face, but could do nothing to slow his descent. He went down the hill, and down. With a sigh, Merrick got to his feet. There was no marker on Gomez's body. He was sure of it. Kate stood beside him, biting her lip. I know, she said, there was a spare. I know it. I don't know where it is, Merrick said. Unconsciously, Kate started to scratch her head, and felt the wig and the pain from the bump on her head. This damn wig. She stopped. She stared at Merrick. And then she walked away into the woods along the edge of the path. Where did it go? She said. What? Her head. She found it a moment later, surprised at how small it seemed. A head without a body wasn't very big. She tried not to look at the stump of the neck. Fighting revulsion, she crouched down and turned the head over, so that she was looking at the gray face, the sightless eyes. The tongue half protruded from the slack jaw. Flies buzzed inside the mouth. She lifted the wig away and immediately saw the ceramic marker. It was taped to the mesh inside the wig. She pulled it free. Got it, she said. Kate turned it over in her hand. She saw the button in the side of the marker where there was a small light. The button was so small and narrow it could only be pushed with a thumbnail. This was it. They had definitely found it. Merrick came over and stared at the ceramic. Looks like it to me, he said. So we can go back, Kate said, any time we want. Do you want to go back? Merrick asked her. She thought it over. We came here to get the professor, she said, and I think that's what we ought to do. Merrick grinned. And then they heard thundering hooves, and they dived into the bushes just moments before six dark horsemen galloped down the muddy path, heading toward the river below. Chris staggered forward, knee-deep in boggy marsh at the edge of the river. Mud clung to his face, his hair, his clothes. He was covered in so much mud that he felt its weight. He saw the boy ahead of him, already splashing in the water, washing. Pushing past the last of the tangles along the water's edge, Chris slid into the river. The water was icy cold, but he didn't care. He ducked his head under, ran his hand through his hair, rubbed his face, trying to get the mud off him. By now the boy had climbed out on the opposite bank and was sitting in the sun on a rocky outcrop. The boy said something that Chris could not hear, but his earpiece translated. You do not remove your clothes to bathe? Why? You did not. At this, the boy shrugged. But you may, if you wish it. Chris swam to the far side and climbed out. His clothes were still very muddy, and he felt chilled now that he was out in the open air. He stripped off his clothes down to his belt and linen breeches, rinsed the outer garments in the river, then set them on the rocks to dry. His body was covered with scratches, welts, and bruises, but already his skin was drying and the sun felt warm. He turned his face upward, closed his eyes. He heard the soft song of women in the fields. He heard birds. The gentle lap of the river at the banks, and for a moment, he felt a peace descend on him that was deeper and more complete than anything he had ever felt in his life. He lay down on the rocks, and he must have fallen asleep for a few minutes, because when he awoke he heard,
Howbeit thou speakst full simple, O Copan, eke in which are thou art? Essay thou sooth Irish?
The boy was speaking. An instant later he heard the tinny voice in his ear translating. The way you speak plainly to your friend, and the way you dress, tell the truth. You are Irisher, is it so? Chris nodded slowly, thinking that over. Apparently the boy had overheard him speaking to Merrick on the path, and had concluded they were Irish. There didn't seem to be any harm in letting him think that. I, he said.
I?
The boy repeated. He formed the syllable slowly, pulling his lips back, showing his teeth.
I?
The word seemed strange to him. Chris thought, he doesn't understand I? He would try something else. He said, we?
We?
We? The boy seemed confused by this word as well. Then he brightened.
Uri? Sends thou Uri?
And the translation came.
Shabby?
Are you saying shabby? Chris shook his head no.
I am saying yes.
This was getting very confusing.
Yes?
The boy said, speaking it like a hiss.
Yes,
Chris said, nodding.
Ah, Irwisher.
The translation came.
Ah,
Irish.
Yes. Ween sayin' yea so, or a wis thou say true.
Chris said, thou say true. His earpiece translated his own words. You speak the truth. The boy nodded, satisfied with the answer. They sat in silence a moment. He looked Chris up and down. So, you are gentle?
Gentle? Chris shrugged. Of course he was gentle. He certainly wasn't a fighter.
Thou say true. The boy nodded judiciously. I thought as much. Your manner speaks it, even if your attire ill suits your degree. Chris said nothing in reply. He wasn't sure what was meant here. How are you called? The boy asked him.
Christopher Hughes.
Ah,
Christopher de Hughes, the boy said, speaking slowly. He seemed to be assessing the name in some way that Chris didn't understand. Where is Hughes? In the Irish land? Thou say true. Another short silence fell over them while they sat in the sun.
Are you a knight?
The boy asked finally.
No.
Then you are a squire, the boy said, nodding to himself.
That will do.
He turned to Chris. And of what age? 21 year? Close enough. 24 year. This news caused the boy to blink in surprise. Chris thought, what's wrong with being 24? Then, good squire, I am very glad of your assistance, for saving me from Sir Guy and his band. He pointed across the river where 6 dark horsemen stood watching them at the water's edge. They were letting their horses drink from the river, but their eyes were fixed on Chris and the boy.
But I didn't save you, Chris said. You saved me.
Didn't?
Another puzzled look. Chris sighed. Apparently these people didn't use contractions. It was so difficult to express even the simplest thought. He found the effort exhausting, but he tried again. Yet I did not save you, you saved me.
Good squire, you are too humble, the boy replied. I am in your debt for my very life, and it shall be my pleasure to see to your needs once we are to the castle.
Chris said,
the castle?
Cautiously, Kate and Merrick moved out of the woods heading toward the monastery. They saw no sign of the riders who had galloped down the trail. The scene was peaceful. Directly ahead were the monastery's farm plots, demarcated by low stone walls. At the corner of one plot was a tall hexagonal monument, carved as ornately as the spire of a Gothic church.
Is that a Montjoie? She said.
Very good, Merrick said. Yes, it's a milestone or a landmarker. You see them all over.
They moved between the plots, heading toward the 10-foot-high wall that surrounded the entire monastery. The peasants in the field paid no attention to them. On the river, a barge drifted downstream, its cargo bundled in cloth. A boatman standing in the stern sang cheerfully. Near the monastery wall were clustered the huts of the peasants who worked in the field. Beyond the huts he saw a small door in the wall. The monastery covered such a large area that it had doors on all 4 sides. This was not the main entrance, but Merrick thought that it would be better to try here first. They were moving among the huts when he heard the snort of a horse and the soft, reassuring voice of a groom. Merrick held out his hand, stopping Kate.
What?
She whispered. He pointed. About 20 yards away, hidden from easy view behind one of the huts, 5 horses were held by a groom. The horses were richly appointed, with saddles covered in red velvet, trimmed with silver. Strips of red cloth ran down the flanks. Those aren't farm horses, Merrick said, but he didn't see the riders anywhere.
What do we do?
Kate said. Chris Hughes was following the boy toward the village of Castelgar when his earpiece suddenly crackled. He heard Kate say,
What do we do?
And Merrick answered, I'm not sure. Chris said,
Have you found the professor?
The boy turned and looked back at him. Do you speak to me, Squire?
No, boy, Chris said. Just to myself.
Just to myself?
The boy repeated, shaking his head.
Your speech is difficult to comprehend.
In the earpiece, Merrick said, Chris, where the hell are you?
Going to the castle, Chris said aloud, on this lovely day.
He looked up at the sky as he spoke, trying to make it appear as if he was talking to himself. He heard Merrick say, Why are you going there? Are you still with the boy?
Yes, very lovely.
The boy turned back again with a worried look on his face.
Do you speak to the air? Are you with sound mind?
Yes, Chris said. I am with sound mind. I wish only that my companions might join me in the castle.
Why? Merrick said in his earpiece.
I am sure they shall join you in good time, the boy said. Tell me of your companions. Are they Irish or two? Are they gentles like you or servants?
In his ear, Merrick said, Why did you tell him you are gentle?
Because it describes me.
Chris, gentle means you are nobility, Merrick said. Gentle man, gentle woman, it means of noble birth. You'll draw attention to yourself and get embarrassing questions about your family, which you can't answer.
Oh,
Chris said.
I am sure it does describe you, the boy said. And your copains as well? They are gentles?
You speak true, Chris said. My companions are gentles too. Chris, goddammit, Merrick said through the earpiece. Don't fool with what you don't understand. You're asking for trouble. And if you keep on this way, you will get it. Standing at the edge of the peasant huts, Merrick heard Chris say,
You just get the professor, will you?
And then the boy asked Chris another question, but it was obscured by a burst of static. Merrick turned and looked across the river toward Castelgar. He could see the boy walking slightly ahead of Chris. Chris, Merrick said, I see you. Turn around and come back. Join us here. We have to stay together.
Most difficult.
Why? Merrick said, frustrated.
Chris didn't answer him directly. And who, good sir, may be the horseman on the far bank?
Apparently he was talking to the boy. Merrick shifted his gaze, saw mounted riders at the river's edge, letting their horses drink, watching them go.
That is Sir Guy de Malagon, called Guy Tête Noire. He is retained in the service of my Lord Oliver. Sir Guy is a knight of renown for his many acts of murder and villainy.
Listening, Kate said,
He can't come back to us here because of the knights on horseback. You speak true, Chris said.
Merrick shook his head. He should never have left us in the first place. The creak of a door behind them made Merrick turn. He saw the familiar figure of Professor Edward Johnston coming through the side door of the monastery wall and stepping into sunlight. He was alone. 35 hours, 31 minutes, 11 seconds. Edward Johnston was wearing a doublet of dark blue and black hose. The clothes were plain with little decoration or embroidery, lending him a conservative, scholarly air. He could indeed pass for a London clerk on a pilgrimage, Merrick thought. Probably that was the way Geoffrey Chaucer, another clerk of the time, had dressed on his own pilgrimage. The professor stepped carelessly into the morning sun and then staggered a little. They rushed up to his side and saw that he was panting. His first words were, Do you have a marker? Yes, Merrick said.
It's just the two of you?
No, Chris also, but he's not here.
Johnston shook his head in quick irritation.
All right, quickly, this is how it is. Oliver's in Castelgar. He nodded to the town across the river. But he wants to move to Laroque before Arnaud arrives. His great fear is that secret passage that goes into Laroque. Oliver wants to know where it is. Everyone around here is mad to discover it because both Oliver and Arnaud want it so badly.
It's the key to everything. People here think I'm wise. The abbot asked me to search the old documents, and I found... The door behind them opened, and soldiers in maroon and gray surcoats rushed them. The soldiers cuffed Merrick and Kate, knocking them away roughly, and Kate nearly lost her wig. But they were careful with the professor, never touching him, walking on either side of him. The soldiers seemed respectful, as if they were a protective escort. Getting to his feet and dusting himself off, Merrick had the feeling they had been instructed not to injure him. Merrick watched in silence as Johnston and the soldiers mounted up and set off on the road.
"What do we do?" Kate whispered.
The professor tapped the side of his head. They heard him say in a sing-song, as if praying, "Follow me. I'll try to get us all together. You get Chris."
35 hours, 25 minutes, 18 seconds. Following the boy, Chris came to the entrance to Kesselgar. Double wooden doors, heavily reinforced with iron braces. The doors now stood open, guarded by a soldier in a surcoat of burgundy and gray. The guard greeted them by saying, "Setting a tent? Laying a ground cloth? It is 5 sols to sell in the market on tournament day."
"Non sumus mercatores," the boy said. "We are not merchants."
Chris heard the guard reply, "And thou beast, ye scula paean, quinque sols maintenant aut decem postea."
But the translation did not follow immediately in his ear. He realized the guard was speaking an odd mixture of English, French, and Latin. Then he heard, "If you are, you must pay. 5 sols now, or 10 later." The boy shook his head. "Do you see merchant wares?"
"Hercle, non."
"In the earpiece?"
"By Hercules, I do not."
"Then you are answered." Despite his youth, the boy spoke sharply, as if accustomed to commanding. The guard merely shrugged and turned away. The boy and Chris passed through the doors and entered the village. Immediately inside the walls were several farmhouses and fenced plots. This area smelled strongly of swine. They made their way past thatched houses and pens of grunting pigs, then climbed steps to a winding cobblestone street with stone buildings on both sides. Now they were in the town itself. The street was narrow and busy, and the buildings 2 stories high, with the 2nd story overhanging, so no sunlight reached the ground. The buildings were all open shops on the ground floor, a blacksmith, a carpenter who also made barrels, a tailor, and a butcher. The butcher, wearing a spattered oilskin apron, was slaughtering a squealing pig on the cobblestone in front of his shop. They stepped around the flowing blood and coils of pale intestine. The street was noisy and crowded, the odor almost overpowering to Chris as the boy led him onward. They emerged in a cobbled square with a covered market in the center. Back at their excavations, this was just a field. He paused, looking around, trying to match what he knew with what he now saw. Across the square, a well-dressed young girl, carrying a basket of vegetables, hurried over to the boy and said with concern,
"My dear sir, your long absence does vex Sir Daniel sorely."
The boy looked annoyed to see her. He replied irritably, "Then tell my uncle I will attend him in good time." "He will be most glad of it," the girl said, and hurried away down a narrow passage. The boy led Chris in another direction. He made no reference to his conversation, just walked onward, muttering to himself. They came now to an open ground directly in front of the castle. It was a bright and colorful place, with knights parading on horses carrying rippling banners. "Many visitors today," the boy said, "for the tournament." Directly ahead was the drawbridge leading into the castle. Chris looked up at the looming walls, the high turrets. Soldiers walked the ramparts, staring down at the crowds. The boy led him forward without hesitation. Chris heard his feet thump hollowly on the wood of the drawbridge. There were 2 guards at the gate. He felt his body tense as he came closer. But the guards paid no attention at all. One nodded to them absently. The other had his back turned and was scraping mud from his shoe. Chris was surprised at their indifference. "They do not guard the entry?"
"Why should they?" the boy said. "It is daytime, and we are not under attack."
3 women, their heads wrapped in white cloth, so that only their faces showed, walked out of the castle carrying baskets. The guards again hardly noticed. Chattering and laughing, the women walked out, unchallenged. Chris realized that he was confronted by one of those historical anachronisms so deeply ingrained, no one ever thought to question it. Castles were strongholds. and they always had a defensible entrance, a moat, drawbridge, and so on. And everybody assumed that the entrance was fiercely guarded at all times. But as the boy had said, why should it be? In times of peace, the castle was a busy social center. People coming and going to see the Lord to deliver goods. There was no reason to guard it, especially, as the boy said, during daytime. Chris found himself thinking of modern office buildings, which had guards only at night. During the day, the guards were present, but only to give information, and that was probably what these guards did, too. On the other hand, as he walked through the entrance, he glanced up at the spikes of the portcullis, the large iron grate now raised above his head. That grate could be lowered in a moment, he knew, and if it was, there would be no entry into the castle, and no escape. He had entered the castle easily enough, but he was not sure it would be as easy to leave. They entered a large courtyard, stone on all sides. There were many horses here. Soldiers wearing maroon and gray tunics sat in small groups, eating their midday meal. He saw passageways of wood high above him, running the length of the walls. Directly ahead, he saw another building, with three-story high stone walls and turrets above. It was a castle within the castle. The boy led him toward it. To one side, a door stood open. A single guard munched a piece of chicken. The boy said, "We are to the Lady Claire. She wishes this Irisher to do her service." "So be it," the guard grunted, uninterested. They went inside. Chris saw an archway directly ahead leading to the great hall, where a crowd of men and women stood talking. Everyone seemed richly dressed. Their voices echoed off the stone walls. But the boy did not give him much opportunity to look. He led Chris up a winding, narrow stair to the second floor, then down a stone corridor, and finally into a suite of rooms. Three maids, all dressed in white, rushed forward to the boy and embraced him. They appeared very relieved.
"By the grace of God, my lady, you are returned,"
Chris said. "My lady?" Even as he said it, the black hat was thrown away, and golden hair tumbled down over her shoulders. She gave a little bow that turned into a curtsy.
"I am heartfelt sorry, and beg your forgiveness for this deception."
"Who are you?" Chris said, stunned.
"I am called Claire."
She rose from her curtsy and looked directly into his eyes. He saw that she was older than he had thought, perhaps 22 or 23, and very beautiful. He gaped and said nothing. He had no idea what to say or to do. He felt foolish and awkward. In the silence, one of the maids came forward, curtsied, and said,
"If it please you, she is the Lady Claire of Eltham,
newly widowed of Sir Geoffrey of Eltham, who holds great estates in Guienne and Middlesex. Sir Geoffrey died of his wounds from Poitiers, and now Sir Oliver, ruler of this castle, serves as my lady's guardian. Sir Oliver feels she must be married again, and he has chosen Sir Guy de Maligon, a nobleman well known in these regions. But this match my lady refuses." Claire turned and shot the girl a warning glance, but the girl, oblivious, chattered on.
"My lady says to all the world that Sir Guy lacks the means to defend her estates in France and England. Yet Sir Oliver will have his fee from this match, and Guy has Elaine."
"Milady," the girl said, scurrying backward. She rejoined the other maids who whispered in the corner, apparently chastising her.
"Enough talk," Claire said. "Here is my savior of this day, Squire Christopher of Hughes. He has delivered me from the predations of Sir Guy, who sought to take by force what he could not win freely at court."
Chris said, "No, no, that is not what happened at all." He broke off as he realized that everyone was staring at him, their mouths open, their eyes wide.
"Sooth, he speaks queerly," Claire said, "for he comes from some remote part in the lands of Ire, and he is modest, as befits a gentle. He did save me, so I shall today introduce him to my guardian, once Christopher has proper attire."
She turned to one of the ladies.
"Is not our horse-master, Squire Brandon, of his same length? Go to and fetch me his indigo doublet, his silver belt, and his best white hose."
She handed the girl a purse.
"Pay what he asks, but be quick."
The girl scurried off. As she left, she passed a gloomy elderly man standing in the shadows, watching. He wore a rich robe of maroon velvet with silver fleur-de-lis embroidered on it, and an ermine collar.
"How now, my lady?" he said, coming forward.
She curtsied to him.
Well, Sir Daniel.
You are safely returned.
I give thanks to God.
The gloomy man snorted. As well you should. You strain even his patience. And did your trip yield success equal to its dangers?
Claire bit her lip. I fear not.
Did you see the abbot?
A slight hesitation. No.
Speak me the truth, Claire.
The girl shook her head. Sir, I did not. He was abroad on a hunt.
A pity, Sir Daniel said. Why did you not await him?
I dared not do so, for Lord Oliver's men broke sanctuary to take the magister away by force. I feared discovery, and so fled.
Yes, yes, this troublesome magister, Sir Daniel reflected gloomily. He is on every tongue. Do you know what they say? That he can make himself appear in a flash of light.
Sir Daniel shook his head. It was impossible to tell whether he believed it or not.
He must be a skilled magister of the gunpowder.
He pronounced it gunpowder and spoke the word slowly, as if it were exotic and unfamiliar.
Did you set eyes upon this magister?
Indeed, I spoke to him.
Oh?
With the abbot gone, I sought him out, for they say the magister has befriended the abbot these recent days.
Chris Hughes was struggling to follow this conversation, and he realized belatedly that they were talking about the professor. He said, Magister? Claire said,
Do you know the magister?
Edouard de Jans?
He immediately backpedaled.
No. No, I don't. And at this, Sir Daniel stared at Chris in open astonishment. He turned to Claire. What does he say?
He says he does not know the magister.
The old man remained astonished. In what tongue?
A kind of English, Sir Daniel, with some Gaelic, so I believe.
No Gaelic as I have ever heard, he said. He turned to Chris. Speak you la langue d'oc? No. Lo querisque de Latina?
He was asking if he spoke Latin. Chris had an academic knowledge of Latin, a reading knowledge. He'd never tried to speak it. Faltering, he said,
Non, Señor Danielis, solum per paululum pedolio.
Only a little. Sorry.
Per. Dicendo ille Cicerone per similis est. He speaks like Cicero.
Perdolio. Sorry.
Then you may profitably be silent. The old man turned back to Claire. What did the magister say to you?
He could not assist me.
Did he know the secret we seek?
He said he did not.
But the abbot knows, said Sir Daniel. The abbot must know. It was his predecessor, the bishop of Laon, who served as architect for the last repairs of La Roque.
Claire said, The magister said that Laon was not the architect.
No, Sir Daniel frowned. And how does the magister know that?
I believe the abbot told him, or perhaps he saw it among the old papers.
The magister has undertaken to sort and arrange the parchments of Saint-Mère for the benefit of the monks.
Does he? Sir Daniel said thoughtfully. I wonder why. I had no time to ask before Lord Oliver's men broke sanctuary.
Well, the magister will be here soon enough, Sir Daniel said, and Lord Oliver himself will ask these questions.
He frowned, clearly unhappy at this thought. The old man turned abruptly to a young boy of 9 or 10 standing behind him.
Take Squire Christopher to my chamber where he may bathe and clean himself.
At this, Claire shot the old man a hard look. Uncle, do not thwart my plans.
Have I ever done so?
You know that you have tried.
Dear child, he said, my sole concern is ever for your safety and your honor.
And my honor, uncle, is not yet pledged.
With that, Claire walked boldly up to Chris, put her hand around his neck, and looked into his eyes.
I shall count every moment you are gone, and miss you with all my heart, she said softly, her eyes liquid. Return to me soon. She brushed her lips lightly across his mouth and stepped back, releasing him reluctantly, fingers trailing away from his neck. He felt dazed, staring into her eyes, seeing how beautiful.
Sir Daniel coughed, turned to the boy. See to Squire Christopher, and assist him in his bath.
The boy bowed to Chris. Everyone in the room was silent.
This was apparently his cue to leave. He nodded and said, "I thank you." He waited for the astonished looks, but for once there were none. They seemed to understand what he had said. Sir Daniel gave him a frosty nod, and Chris left the room.
Hours, 55 minutes, 54 seconds. The horses clattered across the drawbridge. The professor stared straight ahead, ignoring the soldiers who escorted him. The guards at the castle gate barely glanced up as the riders entered the castle. Then the professor was gone from sight. Standing near the drawbridge, Kate said, "What do we do now? Do we follow him?" Merrick didn't answer her. Looking back, she saw that he was staring fixedly at two knights on horseback, fighting with broadswords on the field outside the castle. It appeared to be some kind of demonstration or practice. The knights were surrounded by a circle of young men in livery, some wearing bright green, the others in yellow and gold, apparently the colors of the two knights. And a large group of spectators had gathered, laughing and shouting insult and encouragement to one knight or the other. The horses turned in tight circles, almost touching each other, bringing their armored riders face to face. The swords clanged again and again in the morning air. Merrick stared without moving. She tapped him on the shoulder. "Listen, Andre, the professor, in a minute, but in a minute." For the first time, Merrick felt a twinge of uncertainty. Until now, nothing he had seen in this world had seemed out of place or unexpected. The monastery was just as he had expected. The peasants in the field were as he had expected. The tournament being set up was as he had pictured it. And when he entered Castelgar, he again found it exactly as he had thought it would be. Kate had been appalled by the butcher on the cobblestone and the stench of the tanner's vats, but Merrick was not. It was all as he had imagined it, years ago. "But not this," he thought, watching the knights fight. It was so fast. The swordplay was so swift and continuous, attempting to slash with both downswing and backswing, so that it looked more like fencing than sword fighting. The clangs of impact came only a second or two apart, and the fight proceeded without hesitation or pause. Merrick had always imagined these fights as taking place in slow motion, ungainly armored men wielding swords so heavy that each swing was an effort, carrying dangerous momentum and requiring time to recover and reset before the next swing. He had read accounts of how exhausted men were after battle, and he had assumed it was the result of the extended effort of slow fights encased in steel. These warriors were big and powerful in every way. Their horses were enormous, and they themselves appeared to be 6 feet or more and extremely strong. Merrick had never been fooled by the small size of the armor in museum display cases. He knew that any armor that found its way into a museum was ceremonial and had never been worn in anything more hazardous than a medieval parade. Merrick also suspected, though he could not prove it, that much of the surviving armor, highly decorated, chiseled, and chased, was intended only for display and had been made at 3/4 scale. The better to show the delicacy of the craftsman's designs. Genuine battle armor never survived, and he had read enough accounts to know that the most celebrated warriors of medieval times were invariably big men, tall, muscular, and unusually strong. They were from the nobility, they were better fed, and they were big. He had read how they trained, and how they delighted in performing feats of strength for the amusement of the ladies. And yet somehow he had never imagined anything remotely like this. These men fought furiously, swiftly, and continuously, and it looked as if they could go all day. Neither gave the least indication of fatigue. If anything, they seemed to be enjoying their exertions. As he watched their aggressiveness and speed, Merrick realized that left to his own devices, this was exactly the way he himself would choose to fight. Quickly, with the conditioning and reserves of stamina to wear down an opponent. He had only imagined a slower fighting style from an unconscious assumption that men in the past were weaker or slower or less imaginative than he was as a modern man. Merrick knew this assumption of superiority was a difficulty faced by every historian. He just hadn't thought he was guilty of it. but clearly he was. It took him a while to realize, through the shouting of the crowd, that the combatants were in such superb physical condition that they could expend breath shouting as they fought. They hurled a stream of taunts and insults to each other between blows. And then he saw that their swords were not blunted, that they were swinging real battle swords with razor-sharp edges. Yet they clearly intended each other no harm. This was just an amusing warm-up to the coming tournament. Their cheerful, casual approach to deadly hazard was almost as unnerving as the speed and intensity with which they fought. The battle continued for another 10 minutes until one mighty swing unhorsed the opponent. The knight fell to the ground but immediately jumped up as easily as if he were wearing no armor and laughing. Money changed hands. There were cries of, "Again! Again!" A fistfight broke out among the liveried boys. The two knights walked off arm in arm toward the inn. Merrick heard Kate say, "Andre." He turned slowly toward her. "Andre, is everything all right?"
"Everything is fine," he said. "But I have a lot to learn."
They walked down the castle drawbridge, approaching the guards. He felt Kate tense alongside him.
"What do we do? What do we say?"
"Don't worry, I speak Occitan."
But as they came closer, another fight broke out on the field beyond the moat, and the guards watched it. They were entirely preoccupied as Merrick and Kate passed through the stone arch and entered the castle courtyard.
"We just walked in," Kate said, surprised.
She looked around the courtyard.
"Now what?"
It was freezing, Chris thought. He sat naked, except for his undershorts, on a stool in Sir Daniel's small apartment. Beside him was a basin of steaming water and a handcloth for washing. The boy had brought the basin of water up from the kitchen, carrying it as if it were gold. His manner indicated that it was a sign of favor to be treated to hot water. Chris had dutifully scrubbed himself, refusing the boy's offer of assistance. The bowl was small and the water soon black, but eventually he'd managed to scrape the mud from beneath his fingernails off his body and even off his face, with the aid of a tiny metal mirror the boy handed him. Finally, he pronounced himself satisfied, but the boy, with a look of distress, said,
"Master Christopher, you are not clean,"
and he insisted on doing the rest. So Chris sat shivering on this wooden stool while the boy scrubbed him for what seemed like an hour. Chris was perplexed. He'd always thought that medieval people were dirty and smelly, immersed in the filth of the age. Yet these people seemed to make a fetish of cleanliness. Everyone he saw in the castle was clean, and there were no odors. Even the toilet, which the boy insisted he use before bathing, was not as awful as Chris had expected. Located behind a wooden door in the bedroom, it was a narrow closet, fitted with a stone seat above a basin that drained into a pipe. Apparently, waste flowed down to the ground floor of the castle, where it was removed daily. The boy explained that each morning a servant flushed the pipe with scented water, then placed a fresh bouquet of sweet-smelling herbs in a clip on the wall, so the odor was not objectionable. In fact, he thought ruefully, he'd smelled much worse in airplane toilets. And to top it all, these people wiped themselves with strips of white linen. No, he thought, things were not as bad as he had expected. One advantage of being forced to sit there was that he was able to try speaking to the boy. The boy was tolerant and replied slowly to Chris, as if to an idiot. But this enabled Chris to hear him before the earpiece translation, and he quickly discovered that imitation helped. If he overcame his embarrassment and employed the archaic phrases he had read in text, many of which the young boy himself used, then the boy understood him much more easily. So Chris gradually fell to saying, "Methinks," instead of "I think," and "an," instead of "if," and "forsooth," instead of "in truth." And with each small change, the boy seemed to understand him better. Chris was still sitting on the stool when Sir Daniel entered the room. He brought neatly folded clothes, rich and expensive. He placed them on the bed.
"So, Christopher of Hughes, you have involved yourself with our clever beauty.
She hath saved mine life." He pronounced it saved, and Sir Daniel seemed to understand.
"I hope it will not cause you trouble."
"Trouble?"
Sir Daniel sighed. She tells me, friend Chris, that you are gentle, yet not a knight. You are a squire? In sooth, yes. A very old squire, Sir Daniel said. What is your training at arms?
My training at arms? Chris frowned.
Well, I have, have you any at all? Speak plain, what is your training?
Chris decided he had better tell the truth.
In sooth, I am trained in my studies as a scholar.
A scholar? The old man shook his head, incomprehending.
Escolier? Esne discipulus? Studesne sub magistro? You study under a master?
Ita est.
Even so. Ubi. Where?
Oxford.
Oxford? Sir Daniel snorted. Then you have no business here with such as my lady. Believe me when I say this is no place for a scholar. Let me tell you how your circumstances now lie. Lord Oliver needs money to pay his soldiers, and he has plundered all he can from the nearby towns. So now he presses Claire to marry, that he may gain his fee. Guy de Malagon has tendered a handsome offer, very pleasing to Lord Oliver. But Guy is not wealthy, and he cannot make good on his fee unless he mortgages part of my lady's holdings. To this she will not accede. Many believe that Lord Oliver and Guy have long since made a private agreement, one to sell the Lady Claire, the other to sell her lands.
Chris said nothing.
There is further impediment to the match. Claire despises Malagon, whom she suspects had a hand in her husband's death. Guy was in attendance of Geoffrey at the time of his death. Everyone was surprised by the suddenness of his departure from this world. Geoffrey was a young and vigorous knight. Although his wounds were serious, he made steady recovery. No one knows the truth of that day, yet there are rumors, many rumors, of poison.
I see, Chris said.
Do you? I doubt it. For consider, my lady might as well be a prisoner of Lord Oliver in this castle. She may herself slip out, but she cannot secretly remove her entire retinue. If she secretly departs and returns to England, which is her wish, Lord Oliver will take his revenge against me and others of her household. She knows this, and so she must stay. Lord Oliver wishes her to marry, and my lady devises stratagems to postpone it. It is true she is clever, but Lord Oliver is not a patient man, and he will force the matter soon. Now her only hope lies there.
Sir Daniel walked over and pointed out the window. Chris came to the window and looked. From this high window he saw a view over the courtyard and the battlements of the outer castle wall. Beyond he saw the roofs of the town, then the town wall with guards walking the parapets, then fields and countryside stretching off into the distance. Chris looked at Sir Daniel questioningly. Sir Daniel said,
"There, my scholar, the fires."
He was pointing in the far distance, squinting. Chris could just make out faint columns of smoke disappearing into the blue haze. It was at the limit of what he could see.
"That is the company of Arnaud de Cerveau," Sir Daniel said. "They are encamped no more than 15 miles distant. They will reach here in a day, 2 days at most. All know it."
"And Sir Oliver?"
"He knows his battle with Arnaud will be fierce."
"And yet he holds a tournament?"
"That is a matter of his honor," Sir Daniel said. "His prickly honor. Certes, he would disband it if he could, but he does not dare. And herein lies your hazard."
"My hazard?"
Sir Daniel sighed. He began pacing. "Dress you now to meet my Lord Oliver in proper fashion. I shall try to avert the coming disaster."
The old man turned and walked out of the room. Chris looked at the boy. He had stopped scrubbing.
"What disaster?" he said.
32 hours, 40 minutes, 51 seconds. It was a peculiarity of medieval scholarship in the 20th century that there was not a single contemporary picture that showed what the interior of a 14th century castle looked like. Not a painting, or an illuminated manuscript image, or a notebook sketch. There was nothing at all from that time. The earliest images of 14th century life had actually been made in the 15th century, and the interiors, and food, and costumes they portrayed were correct for the 15th century, not the 14th. As a result, no modern scholar knew what furniture was used, how walls were decorated, or how people dressed and behaved. The absence of information was so complete that when the apartments of King Edward I were excavated in the Tower of London, the reconstructed walls had to be left as exposed plaster, because no one could say what decorations might have been there. This was also why artists' reconstructions of the 14th century tended to show bleak interiors, rooms with bare walls and few furnishings, perhaps a chair or a chest, but not much else. The very absence of contemporary imagery was taken to imply a sparseness to life at that time. All this flashed through Kate Erickson's mind as she entered the great hall of Kestelgar. What she was about to see, no historian had ever seen before. She walked in, slipping through the crowd following Merrick, and she stared, stunned by the richness and the chaos displayed before her. The great hall sparkled like an enormous jewel. Sunlight streamed through high windows onto walls that gleamed with tapestries laced with gold, so that reflections danced on the red and gold painted ceiling. One side of the room was hung with a vast patterned cloth, silver fleur-de-lis on a background of deep blue. On the opposite wall, a tapestry depicting a battle, knights fighting in full regalia, their armor silver, their surcoats blue and white, red and gold, their fluttering banners threaded with gold. At the end of the room stood a huge ornate fireplace, large enough for a person to walk into without ducking, its carved mantelpiece gilded and shimmering. In front of the fire stood a huge wicker screen, also gilded. And above the mantel hung a patterned tapestry of swans flying on a field of lacy red and gold flowers. The room was inherently elegant, richly and beautifully executed, and rather feminine to modern eyes. Its beauty and refinement stood in marked contrast to the behavior of the people in the room, which was noisy, boisterous, crude. In front of the fire was laid the high table, draped in white linen, with dishes of gold, all heaped high with food. Little dogs scampered across the table, helping themselves to the food as they liked, until the man in the center of the table swatted them away with a curse. Lord Oliver Devanne was about 30, with small eyes set in a fleshy, dissolute face. His mouth was permanently turned down in a sneer. He tended to keep his lips tight, since he was missing several teeth. His clothes were ornate as the room, a robe of blue and gold, with a high-necked gold collar and a fur hat. His necklace consisted of blue stones, each the size of a robin's egg. He wore rings on several fingers, huge oval gems in heavy gold settings. He stabbed with his knife at food and ate noisily, grunting to his companions. But despite the elegant accoutrements, the impression he conveyed was of a dangerous petulance. His red-rimmed eyes darted around the room as he ate, alert to any insult, spoiling for a fight. He was edgy and quick to strike. When one of the little dogs came back to eat again, Oliver unhesitatingly jabbed it in its rear with the point of his knife. The animal jumped off and ran, yelping and bleeding, from the room. Lord Oliver laughed, wiped the dog's blood off the tip of his blade, and continued to eat. The men seated at his table shared the joke. From the look of them, they were all soldiers, Oliver's contemporaries, and all were elegantly dressed, though none matched the finery of his leader. And three or four women, young, pretty, and bawdy, in tight-fitting dresses and with loose, wanton hair, giggling as their hands groped beneath the table, completed the scene. Kate stared,
and a word came unbidden to her mind. Warlord. This